No, Sister Cora, Sheila Ferrier,
Yes.
all the way from Kerry.
Yes.
You're now in Butterfield Avenue,
Yes, number six.
number six, and the Mercy
Mercy
Sister.
Congregation, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was, no, tell me about the original house here.
This house, or this house, we came to live here in 99.
This is 10 years ago, but
10 years ago.
before that.
Before that, I was 5 years I was stationed up in Ballyroan Convent. It was called St. Mary's, Ballyroan. And we began work there, our sisters, as a in a preventorium, for the children with TB, because it faced out to the Dublin Mountains off Scholarstown Road. And that house had come to our community through the McCabe family. One of the sisters, there were three sisters, I think, and one brother. The brother, McCabe brother, emigrated to South Africa and was not interested in taking over this kind of quite a large farmhouse they had up there, and a good bit of land going with it. And the sisters didn't marry, the two sisters, and the other entered the convent, so it came to the community to be used for charitable purposes. I think Rathfarnham then and Ballyroan around this area would have been very much country, really. It was 1932. So I'd say for the first 8 to 10 years, maybe or so, some of the sisters came out from Cork Street, which is in the inner city in the Liberties area, at the weekends, and I think they ran kind of holiday or weekend, some kind of facilities for working girls from in there, for some girls anyway. And they worked the farm for many years, and then it became a preventorium, not owned by us but by the Red Cross. So it was the Red Cross, they ran it on behalf of the Red Cross for children with TB. And then they had a school there for, actually, it was two sisters from Kerry who taught there that I know of. A
Can you
sister,
remember?
Demetra O'Riordan, the Lord to mercy in her. She was Sean O'Riordan, you remember? Sean O'Riordan's sister.
All from Ballyvourney.
No, not that sort of Sean O'Riordan.
Oh, yes,
He
yeah.
was a Redemptorist father. He was quite well known, a Redemptorist priest. And she had a sister in the Mercy congregation with us, Colette. They were from Artfert, yeah, outside that direction, somewhere outside Tralee anyway, the Reardon family came from. And her auntie would have been a Sister Rosary from the Cairdons. I forget now what was her name. I forget, she taught in Colloshdida.
Oh,
You know
yes.
Colloshdida, where I went myself. Now, Sister Demetra was one of the teachers there, and that went on until 1960. And the other was Sister Jacintha Gallivan. I think she'd have been from around the Tarbert area.
Isn't that interesting,
It
yeah?
is.
Coming up from
We don't
Kerry,
have that
yes.
many now from Kerry in our congregation,
Yeah,
really.
but
Yeah.
in those days,
In those days, well, in those days,
it
maybe we had a bit more than we have even now. In my generation, I mean, we don't have any of the younger people very much now. So the preventorium developed that they had a school that they ran for the children. That was still in existence when I entered the convent, and I think the TB had been more or less eradicated by 1960, and the school closed down. But this area was beginning to grow up now. Marion Road, the road that you came up, I think that was one of the early ones, and they had a private school there. I think it was secondary. They had a secondary boarding first, but I think they did junior primary as well, and into the 60s, then mid-60s, the people said they would like a national school in the area, and our community put up that national school, and that was in the grounds of this place we had up in Ballyroan. It's up in kind of a hill. The road you came up Marion Road, if you look straight ahead where you turn to the traffic lights, there was a hill going up there. It was up there. It was, and they are celebrating in the secondary part, which has developed then into a big secondary school for girls, and there was a big primary school, and some of the land also went to the Christian Brothers set up a Cloisteana for the boys' secondary school. So of the four schools in the parish, three are located just up that hill or off it. Okay.
Well, that
Yeah,
is fascinating. No,
it's
but
fascinating.
can I take you to a point where What it, when you entered the convent?
I entered in 56.
Where did you go
I
first?
went Carisfort.
Oh yes, but when you were finished with Carisfort, and you got your degree.
I finished with Carisfort, and I was already qualified as a teacher when I entered. I had trained in Carisfort and taught in Dublin for a year with the Dominican Sisters in Ballyfermot. I entered in 56, and I didn't teach in Blackrock, where Carisfort is. We went out to Coolock every day, four of us, to teach. They were starting a school in Coolock, which is now two big school, three schools have developed around there, two primaries and one secondary, two girls' primary, junior and senior. And Coolock was bought by the community in 1955. It was originally the house owned by the O'Callaghans, who had a big part in the story of our foundress, Catherine Macaulay, the Mercy Sisters. That was the house that she lived in, that she inherited, through which she established Baggot Street and the Mercy community.
My goodness, yeah, so it
Yes,
all
that's
stemmed
Coolock
from
House,
there. It's
Coolock
Coolock
House,
House, yeah.
yes, yeah. So we taught there in the that old house, actually. It had She sold it, you see, to get the money to set up the congregation. Well, she didn't intend to set up a congregation. She intended to set up a house of mercy and to remain a lay woman with helpers, but the church didn't see it that way. So the Archbishop of Dublin at the time asked her to choose between a religious congregation or disband her group. So she chose. You see, she had a lot of Protestant connections, and her father had died very young, and her mother was not kind of was much younger than the father and didn't have the same grip, and then many relatives, Protestants and that, so she really grew up among Protestants rather than Catholics, so she didn't have that kind of, let's say, Nano-Nagles background in the way. But she was very well educated through the Callaghans, who were Quakers, and they chose her as their heiress to carry on the work that she had begun doing when she was there, which was going out visiting the poor and trying to set up work for them in the city. She was, I don't know what age she was now when she entered the, when she became a nun, 22, or she would have been in her 40s into her 50s. So she went off and did her novitiate with the Presentation Sisters in Warrenmount and took set up the Congregation of Mercy, just lived 10 years.
And your responsibility, you were just telling me a while ago,
Yeah.
was looking after the animals
Well,
for
why
her.
I just do that as one of the little jobs
Yeah,
that we do.
but did you ever look back into the old annals
Oh, I
of the
did,
organ?
yes.
And imagine teaching in the same house
House,
as the
yes.
foundress
Exactly,
actually
exactly. Well,
lived
I'll
in.
tell you how I got into the annals. And you see, they were read to us in the refectory during Lent, and when, you know, we didn't always have, we sometimes had reading, always at Lent anyway, and the annals would be read to us, and they were kept up in a certain room we had. We called it Mother Catherine Macaulay Room, and they were pursuing her cause, and a lot of that work was being done through in Carisfort. So a lot of the books, there were a lot of books there, like different places where they went, books that they had written and things they had written back from New York or Mother Austin Carroll, I think New Orleans, and the story of the how they went to Australia and all of these. And we had one old sister called Sister Nathie O'Hara, and she was absolutely like an encyclopedia. She was a genius at mathematics, and she said two things she could do, even in her, I knew her in her 80s, better. She could do any mathematics kind of coaching or exam or whatever would turn up, and anything on the history of the congregation.
My,
She could do
so
that.
she, yeah.
Because we had a big international meeting here in Dublin. It was called Throchra in 1981, and they came from all over the world to celebrate the 150th anniversary, and a lot of them stayed with our convents, and any of them she met, and she'd ask them, where did you come from? And they'd say, anywhere, New Zealand or Australia, or name that. Oh, that was so and so's foundation. She went there, she could say that, yeah, you know.
Yeah,
And
it
it was
was a great
in very, and
networking of job work.
she did tapes like this on all of that. She got it written down, yeah. They got her to write down a lot of that, yes. Because she knew the old sisters who had lived with Mother Macaulay in Baggot Street. Yeah, Beggar Street was our first foundation.
Right, so that would have been very back. Those nuns would have been the founder members, or would have been.
Well, they would have lived there anyway, yeah. Yes.
Or would have been in that community.
Yes.
From Beggar the middle Street. Of the last century.
Yes, yes.
So, how long were you there then in that house?
I was in Carisfort for 2.5 years only, going out to Coolock every day by car across the city. And then after profession, which would be first profession, I went to Moran Road, Drimna.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a very big school that had been set up in 1944, I think. I think there were 1,200 in the infant school or something like that. We certainly had 20 classes, and I don't know how many we would have had in each in my time there. I was in the junior boys section, because there was a junior school and a senior school in the one.
What year then are we talking about?
59, I went out there, 59. And when I entered the convent, 15 entered in that group. And we weren't straight from school. Many of us had gone to college and whatever. And they made the decision. The Archbishop of Dublin had... prior to that, we had kept to primary schools and the teacher training, because really our charism and our mission was to the poor, and that's elementary education rather than secondary at that time anyway. And there were a lot of new districts springing up. Coolock was one, Beaumont was another, Rush was another. They were the ones I remember particularly. And he wanted people trained for the secondary schools. Going to their degree. So we were sent out at night. We were already teaching, and we were sent out to university at night.
Which, UCD?
UCD, yeah.
And you did your degree?
I did my degree, there. I did my BA there, and I did my HDip after it. But before I had finished, we had a mission that went to Nairobi in 1956, the year we entered. And at my final profession, I volunteered to go, because... a friend of mine said, look, the Mother Meld, who was our superior, the Lord of Mercy in her, said, you know, we'd be saying, can see Nairobi, or have we any volunteers? And she said, I don't think we should she should be doing that. We should say we'd go. So I said I'd go on the day of my final profession to wherever. We had a mission in America as well. So within 6 months, I was asked to go. And I was in the middle of my HDip, but I finished my HDip, but before the results were out, I was gone out to Nairobi to fill that vacancy in the school. And that was 63, and I stayed there until 76, the first go. And I taught in secondary school there.
That must have been a huge shock to the system.
Not really.
Did you know what you were getting yourself into?
Well, I didn't. I mean, we didn't question that kind of thing, I suppose, if I said I wouldn't, they wouldn't. But I mean, we didn't say we wouldn't then, anything. Yes, because we were just beginning a second level school there. And we were because our sisters had gone out in 56, not to set up schools, but at the request of the Archbishop of Nairobi to set up a hospital.
No, how bad were they? It was a third world country. It was poverty stricken, was it?
Well, I went out just before independence. They had got internal self-government. They got full independence in December of 1963. When our sisters went out there first, it would have been the emergency Mau Mau time. Hmm. And we were in the city of Nairobi, but we did have a house out in Kikuyu country, and... I do remember the men coming up in 63 and after to the clinic. We had a clinic attached to the convent, with the dreadlocks and the things they had in the forest, you know, these kind of, yeah. And no, it was very peaceful and quiet. But like at that time, very African girls had very, very little opportunity to go to secondary school. And
their traditions, their customs, their beliefs,
yeah.
All of these things were so
different.
Alien to what you were teaching them and what you were trying to...
But, you see, I suppose I passed through Nairobi. I passed through Rome on my way out. It took 3 days to go out that time. Through Raptum and thing, we went all over the place picking up missionaries and whatever. We happened to be in Rome and we were given tickets. We had a day there to go to the... whatever, the cardinals were going into the consistory, whatever they do to elect the Pope. So it was after Pope John, between that and Paul the VI time. So Vatican II, it was in the middle of Vatican II when things were changing quite a bit. So, and I wasn't there among the first group. The first group went out in 1956. And they, you know, the sisters had been there 6 or 7 years, and we were living down in the African location. I think we were actually the first white women that lived down there. I think over Needlevale, which was some nearer to the airport. They would have been Europeans too, but our sisters taught it. They had the first all African girls primary school, I think, in the city, because Nairobi City at that time, up to independence, was zoned according to nationality. You know, there was one section for the European, one section for the African, and one section for the Asian. The school I went to was down in the Asian section because we were primarily meant to be for the Goans. That section of the city was just being opened up to housing and things. And the hospital we had was there because, again, Mother Dolorosa, who set up the hospital, went out in 56 to do it. The first place, the bishop gave them some land up in St. Austin's, which was the first Catholic mission in the highlands up in Kenya. And they weren't allowed there because she had said, just the same as the Charter of the Martyr in Dublin would be, that it was to be all races, creeds, nobody, you know, it was to be open to all nationalities, creeds, etc. And they said the government wouldn't give, or the city council wouldn't give permission for that. They said that can't be in that area. Then the next one she got was down where we had this convent in the African one, and she said open to all nationalities. They said white people can't come down here, you can't have that. So the third choice she got was down in the Asian one, which was formerly kind of Asian, and just opening up. It was very just across the road from the national park in Nairobi, the hospital was down there, and there wasn't a Catholic church at the time. Our school served as Catholic church for a long time, so it was very near quite an unhealthy river, you know, it wasn't a good situation, and it was just across the river there was the industrial area, so it was hard for the doctors to come down, traffic was hard, and you know, but anyway, they set it up there, and this school then was for the Goans of that area, and it wasn't, because the schools were more or less sort of according to nationalities too, like they were the teachers in the African schools would not be as qualified than ordinary teachers. Granted, we got about half of the teacher salaries.
Okay.
Half of the teacher salaries.
So how long were you there?
I was there for 14, yes. 14 years, I think. Just up to 14, I think.
And at that time, your first time going out there, now the Vatican II hadn't, all the changes hadn't come in. So were you wearing those long, heavy robes? And head covers and the heat.
It was bad, yeah, time. But Nairobi is 6,000 feet above sea level, so it wouldn't have been as hot. But we wore them, and I think they wore more before I went out, you know, that they had... But we wore white, you know, and I don't know, you didn't question things that time, you know. Yeah.
And so you're you would have seen in the 17 years 14 years, yeah. And lots of changes in politics there, changes in improvement in education.
Because I think what remains with my mind was the changes in syllabus, you know, they were orienting it towards African, the history, the literature, all of that. I taught history there, and They had changed the syllabus, and we didn't. I mean, we wouldn't have a book when the syllabus would be changed. You know, I remember going up to the university and joining the students for seminars and things. See, would I pick up something about the political, social, and economic organization of the different tribes, such as the Kikuyu and the Luo? And young fellows were just coming back from US and places like that that would have done their PhDs or their studies, and they had the oral thing that they could get, and so it was possible to get a bit of that, and we'd fairly good books after a while. And then we also had to do options, that was East Africa, of West Africa or South Africa or Central, and I was lucky to get a very good teacher who was half Zulu himself, but he was part of the Ndebele, you know, if you remember Red Shack of the Zulus' history, how they all dispersed out up to Zimbabwe now, really. He was in Ndebele, and he'd been sent away from the he was in New Zealand or somewhere where he did the studies. He was doing his PhD, and he was writing books, and he left me all his notes, so I was able to manage the social and the economic and the history, like the Hottentots and the Bushmen and all of that kind of stuff. We had to learn.
So, but what difference did you make when you were out there?
Well, I don't know. I suppose I was able to. We had to build the school ourselves, really. And I think the most significant thing I did was to introduce home science in our school. Now, others, because we weren't a government school, so we had to put up the school ourselves, and that was a very good subject for the, we had a lot, from day one our school would have taken in Africans. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was sufficiently near independence to say that even though it wasn't that area, we did not discriminate on nationality, and we charged a small fee, but it was very little. We ran a very good domestic science program, or home science program. We were able to offer them cookery as a separate subject, and clothing and textiles. We had the little flat to do home management, but we couldn't do it because we weren't a boarding school. You know, they would be meant to live in that and budget and do all of that. And I got an excellent Ursuline sister who had been on the staff in Lochgill, St. Angela's at the time, was working in Kenya, down in Kitui, a very dry area, and she came up and she gave lessons to one of my teachers to do it, who later did so well with the first exam that they gave her a scholarship, the government. She was an African lady, to go to America, first to go to their own college, Kenyatta, to do her degree in home science. Then they gave her one to America, and she's her PhD now, and is an associate professor in the university there. So I think I would think that was a very valuable thing. I was also very keen on literature and history, and we had very good students, really, that came up from the primary school we had ourselves. So they did very well. One came here in the late 60s, and he did his nuclear physics. He was not an African, he was a Goan. And did very well. I mean, he could have got into any university in the world.
And you know, this was the 70s. I mean, we're coming near...
The 60s
still, yeah. But when the apartheid came in, I mean...
That was South Africa.
That was South Africa, sorry.
Yeah. When ours moved the other way, because we were towards Africanization.
Yes.
Okay, yes, yeah.
So was there any... intimidation
no.
at all? You didn't... I mean, were you left alone, or were you at any stage threatened? Or
No, we weren't. We were not a bit afraid to live down in the African location, really, because we had a clinic, and 300 people were coming up to that every day.
And they needed you.
Yeah, well, they were getting a good service there.
Were you sad to leave?
Yes, the first time. It's harder to settle here than to settle out there. Maybe for the first, when I went out for about 18 months or so. We didn't come home for 5 years. So, yes, I suppose I was a bit lonely for a while. But, like, there were others young with me, and we had good fun, you know?
Yeah.
You're young. And I think building up a place is very, very I mean, you can't think of other problems, because I was happy every day I had a teacher in front of the class, and I was more happy if the teacher was teaching her right subject, you know, that it wasn't just holding them quiet with something she didn't know. So we were very blessed with our teachers. We had very good teachers. First, they were gone, Asian teachers, but then gradually we got in some Africans when they became available, and they were excellent too. So, we had a good long stay there, 13 or 14 years, and the primary school was right beside us, and we cooperated like really and helped one another. And
so you went in 1963 and you came back in
the end of 1976.
So that was
December. Yeah.
And so did you come back to a different Ireland when you came back? You know, you were away
yes,
all that time.
Yeah, well, the differences were, to me, I suppose, later on when I came back a second time, I found it changed Ireland entirely. I came back that time really to go back to London and do a postgrad. I was doing it in, they asked me just to pick up a good degree, because I was those that had the Cúpla Focal Gaelic, you know, and they said do something with Irish, you know. I never did learn Kiswahili well. Those who were there before me, the few years right up to independence, had to study Swahili in order to get their increments. Because actually the school where we taught, that one that was grant aided, we were offered kind of comparable salaries to the others, and we were really kind of, it was meant to be a support for the house, because the sisters who taught over in the African schools, or any, even in the training college, if you had a PhD or if you weren't qualified at all, you got the same flat amount, and it was not very great, you know. So we needed to supplement what we had. So, and I think the sister who was there just some years before me, who was with me down in that area, they had been in some kind of a pension fund, and they were permanent and pensionable because they were in British times. But when I came in, it was the transition time, and we were always on temporary terms. We worked with the Holy Ghost Mission. Yeah. So,
oh, did you?
Yeah, yes,
you worked in.
They had an education secretary,
yes.
Yeah, and yeah, that's how we were registered with the government. Yeah. Until 4 years after independence in 1967, the Kenya government set up what they called a unified teacher service that engaged all the teachers, and we had to transfer into it. But we still remained temporary, really, because we weren't citizens.
So, okay, now can we move to
yes,
you're back here again, and you had this opportunity because of your roots in Kerry, I suppose,
yes,
and your Irish.
Yeah.
So can you talk me through that time?
Yeah. I went to London in 77. Well, first I came home in December, because the school year in Kenya finishes in December. It's January to December. It's not September to September. 1977, And there was a vacancy in one of our convent schools where a sister actually had left the congregation. And it was one of these situations that you read about in the paper that, you know, it's still the system. If you have your numbers for a certain X number of teachers on the 30th of September, you keep that teacher till the end of the year, but that teacher won't be replaced. You know what I mean? If there's a certain number of students you have, and they were in that situation. So there were 40 girls in class six in the Liberties in the school, Weaver Square, and their sister left, and they couldn't engage another teacher. So they asked me, would I do it? Because I was at a loose end until I joined the university over. And I said I would. I thought it'd be okay. It was a baptism by fire. I would have been trained 20 years that time. It was so difficult. Like you see, the inner city children, there were about 10 of them at least who would be in university, if not more, if I had them in Africa. You know, let's say, you know.
I know that the standard was
the
much
standard.
Higher.
Yeah. Well, no, but the motivation, really. The motivation. Those girls, some of them, they had lost their competence in sixth class now. They'd lost their competence in reading, some of them, because like they were switched off education, really.
And they were there just because they had to be there.
Yes, some of them.
Not because they wanted to be
there. The principal had
to
go out from that school sometimes and get girls. Not one of them came out of her own door except one. They were in the flats and things, you know, the ones you'd have heard about, Rialto and Dolphin's Barn and some of those that later became famous for very great problems with drugs and things like that. They would have to go up and the attendance officer would have to chase some of the debt. The others had given them jobs, you know, got them jobs because they needed the money. But we could always go into the flats and it was very sad to get them in, you know, but they stayed anyway and they had to stay at school till they were 14. And there were some of them in that class, and I took them anyway. It was the biggest challenge of my life in teaching, and I was not being paid for it. I was not on a paid thing, this was what. The manager was going to see the department, I think, about 6 weeks after I arrived, and I said, would you mind telling them in there that I'm teaching 20 years and I've never had to work as hard in all my life in this continent or in the other one, in Africa, as I have to, and that I think I ought to be paid. So they did pay me.
And what was the name of the school?
It was Weaver Square, I suppose. It's closed now.
But it was called Weaver's.
I think it was Weaver Square.
Weaver Square. Yeah, the experience you got there, I suppose,
there.
was...
Well, it challenged every
minute of
my... Yes, like how do you kind of deal with children who are switched off, who are very brainy, whose parents don't see the need for them to go on to secondary school? I asked some of the parents, would you send on some of those girls up to, I think it was Warren Mount, was the presentation convent near us in Weaver Square, and they said no, she'll go into a factory the same as her sisters. So I wanted to listen very carefully about literacy in these.
So was it an all-girls school at the
all
time?
All-girls at this point.
And was there...
We may have had boys in the lower school, I think. You know, the tradition that they have boys in infant school, in the infant part of the school.
So the catchment area for these children would have been out of deprived areas?
The flats around the city. It had been before... This was after free education, you see, about 10 years. And previous to the Don O'Malley's granting of free education, they would have had a secondary top. You know what they called those ones? Yeah.
Yes.
Which put them through the exams. And when that stopped, because it was attached to the primary section, the better girls went off to secondary school, if you like. You know, and when you have a certain core, when you lose that, it's very hard to keep the standards of work high. And really, the children teach one another as much as the teacher does, you know.
Yeah, but you were, so it was an experience, like you said.
It was a real experience.
But you didn't stick it out too long. You were there.
Well, I was just there for 6 months.
Yes,
but I went over to London. Yeah.
Did you ask to leave?
No, I didn't. I had come home from Nairobi for this purpose, to go to the university.
This was
the 6 months that I had in between until the university term started. Okay, that is, yeah.
All right, so back to Nairobi again?
But no, I didn't go back to Nairobi again. I was very briefly, I got a job in Carisforth College.
Oh, did you? Teaching teachers-to-be?
Teachers-to-be, yes. I think I was on methodologies, the education department, for Irish, really. I took a sojourn in Dunquin for a while to get back my Leofoeth tongue. They told me at the interview, you'd better go back and get back your fluency in Irish, you know.
Back to the home. We'll talk about the Ferreters from West Kerry later. But so when you got your Irish back in Dunquin, and you came back up again, that must have been... very satisfying type of part of your life?
Well, I wouldn't say it was the most satisfying now, really.
Satisfying from the point that you were now you were now doing something that you, I suppose, you were teaching.
Yeah, well, I think when I went to Nairobi, I'd been teaching in Warren Road and other places, and I actually taught infants, and I did my H-dip practicals with infants. And I was on top of my, let's say, after 7 or 8 years, I knew what I was doing, you know. I mean, we go to college and get training, but you get it on the ground, really, you know. And I felt I was on top of that. I went out to Nairobi and I was there. I felt I was on top of it there, which I was. Like, you know, I suppose I was in one way glad to come home that time because I had been there so long and I knew the system very well. And no matter what, there were two things, like, really. I knew it very well, but there was a lot of stuff coming in about the African literature. And I happened to be on leave when they got a very important seminar, Teachers of Literature, which I think James Ngugi and some of those who were very prominent African writers were saying, how could Europeans really teach our history and how can they teach the oral history, which Irish people would say as well, wouldn't they, about the oral. And when I went to London and I was doing education, I saw where they were coming from. It was all about this kind of Marxist kind of critiques of literature and all that kind of stuff. And I could very well see that that's what they were, when they told me what went on at that seminar, I think I lost my taste a bit for teaching literature, you know?
Did you? Yes.
Yeah, that one, that I could see that I could never have it, the experience that an African would have, you know, in teaching the literature.
Yeah, because, are you suggesting that maybe that they know their own oral and their own tradition a lot?
They know their own tradition. Well, it was an important one in it. And, you see, James Ngugi was, he went back to his Kikuyu name, but he wrote plays. And he was, I mean, and many of these who taught literature around that time in the universities and things had to leave the country because they were seen as subversive. He wrote plays in Kikuyu, which he ran for the people of Limuru, which were saying in the 70s, we've got independence, but we haven't got independence. We are still under colonial masters and our own are the people that are doing it for us now, to us now. If those had been given to them in English, they wouldn't have understood it, a lot of the people, but they understood it when it was given to them in their own language, you know. So it was using art, if you like, to be a kind of, whatever you want to say, art can do, can be subversive, it can be develop people, you know. So, yeah. So it was interesting that way. And I really, now, and we had language as a separate subject from literature. You know, when we do our English here, literature, and I said I would have passed me exams well on the literature when I was doing the Latin. It was certainly the history of the thing that did me more than the language. But we had language as a separate one. So I much prefer the language side now. I teach it as a foreign language to some students still. And I have got a great love of the language itself as distinct from doing it, because we don't use literature in teaching it at the basic levels anyway. To speakers of other languages, you know, we give them the language basis. Further on, of course, they could get it, and my aim always is to get them reading, because that's how they do it.
So Carysport, how long were you there?
I was only there for about, I'd say I was supposedly on the staff, but I'd parted that in Dunquin. Only really from about February, I think, until August, because we had elections and I got given a job that in the convent that I had to, I couldn't teach, like, I couldn't combine it with teaching.
What job was that?
Oh, well, in charge of the community, you know.
Oh, were you, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So, did that give you new responsibilities then?
It did. But you know what I found very useful for it? My time in London. Yeah.
And in what way now?
Well, you see, the subjects that I chose, I did my master's there, would have been language and literature in education. And much of the basis, and this would be geared towards schools more, but it was based on the idea that where the children were, like, the children were failing, like I had seen in Cork Street, brainy people, okay? But the school system not suiting them, okay, or the methodologies we were using, that they were the same fit for everybody. Do you know what I mean? We gear it more towards university or whatever, and we say it's one kind of intelligence maybe rather than all the other kinds. So the particular one that I was interested in was the place the talk plays in learning. And it presupposed a different methodology, which I think has partly come into our schools now, that if the children can talk it through and in their own language, you see, you have to get another language in geography, you have to get it in mathematics, you have to get it in all of them. And when they wouldn't have that, if you like, children who come from parents who are, for different reasons, not able to give them that head start in life with a kind of a background that is favourable to the education system, they don't manage to do it very well. So I, if you like, saw that that's a basis of adult education too, and that that was kind of education that our community needed to live in the world we were living in, that if we didn't sit down and talk to one another, it was not possible for us to live, like, really, you know, like, you can't, you know, Paulo Freire talks about that, like, kind of, I don't know, is it he that uses that one about the banking kind of thing, that he did that in Brazil, wasn't it, to say that he gave the people education where they could take hold of their own lives, you know, and decide things for themselves, and that it would not have to be anybody standing in front of a class and pouring out stuff.
Right.
That so it had to be digested. So I found it very useful for...
What did you do then to make a difference? Well, to make things change, yeah.
I thrashed around for quite a while to try to see what we could do. And I think we got in people from... We got some crowd. They were from America. MDI, I think we called them. They kind of took big assemblies of all of us and kind of got us to look at our group and our congregation and say, what are we doing that's dead now, really, in our lives? You know, do you know the way we hold on to many, many things? We're kind of in a kind of a curve like that up, and, you know, what's good, what isn't, and what do we have to let go, what's dead and buried, that has to go. And to do that kind of formative thing with all of the community, to talk, and they trained us how to facilitate groups ourselves, you know. And I had tumbled to it before I left Nairobi, because I was teaching history, and it was history of South Africa, I think, which I said to the students, I'm not going to take you beyond 1948, because that's when that apartheid came in South Africa, and I couldn't find my way through the tangles of that, you know. So with the students, I was coming on leave. I was sure I wouldn't get a history teacher to take my place. I think they were coming up to the exam. It was their O-level exam. And I said to them, I will teach you for the first 6 weeks in the January-February time, and I'll give you all of the books that I would use to learn up the stuff that I don't know myself. And I will be there with you, and you will go into small groups, and you will read it, and we will kind of learn how to talk to one another about it. And then I will, the second part of the term, I will leave you on your own. I'll be just telling you the things, and I give you them all the old topics to do. And I said, I will be gone for the second term, and one of the teachers will come in to see you're doing it, but whatever. I came back for the third term, which was the exam one, and normally I would give them timed questions, and I said to them, somebody was going in to supervise them. She came out and she said, they don't want to do the exam. I said, okay, we'll talk about it on Monday. It was a Friday. And I asked them on Monday, why don't you want to do exams, like, you know, a full paper? They said, we know it. I said, do you? You don't want any more? No, we don't. We know it. Right. It was a smaller group now, because it was against another subject, home science, I think.
But
they all got distinctions except one.
Yeah.
And she was one of the weaker ones. She got a credit. This is the system that's in the English thing. And she didn't pass any other subject, I think, barely. And I said it was because I let them do it themselves, okay? That they were doing their own learning.
So did you pass that on then? You kind of, you took that experience with you, and you brought it here, and you instilled it, you
well, I just
it
did it. I just did it with my own community in that one.
Now, what, so when you say you were in charge of What community?
It was the Dublin group at the time.
The Dublin group?
Yes, yeah.
So you had for full responsibility years. For yes, all the different
yes. so we communities got this, yes, in the yes, area. Yeah, yeah.
And were you met with any challenges?
Well, I mean, people were nervous about it and things. Of course I was. I mean, Jervis Street Hospital, we withdrew from that at the time, and there's great resistance when you do that. That was one of them that I remember. We had to take the decision to, in the Mater Hospital, to build the private. You know, the buck stops with you and with that one, you know, if you have to authorise permissions and things like that, you know. I wasn't doing the work, but luckily we had a very good sister who took care of that, and we had a very good lay group.
But were you delegating the work?
Well, I had we had counsellors and things, yes. And I mean, we had a finance committee that would have been very useful with advice on that, and they would have had committees of their own. Okay.
And did you make decisions then to sell some of the houses, the bigger houses, or was
we
that
didn't,
your...
We didn't sell any of them. And at the same time, I think I was the one that was there when the grant was withdrawn from Carisforth College.
And what did that mean?
That meant that the grant withdrawn meant that the college, I think it ran one or two more years, but that it was phased out. Do you not remember that happening?
What year was
that? That was 86, I think. 85 or 86.
And how were you surprised by that decision that was made?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Archbishop was really the manager of the college, you know, but we had some sister in charge. There was a president.
Why do you think it was withdrawn?
I think they felt that the colleges were surplus to their needs, and at the time the opinion was that Limerick, I think it was Noonan, the person who was, yeah, and that Gemma Hussey, I don't want this to be going into the public arena now, but that Gemma, like that the argument for Limerick was stronger than it was for Carisforth, but I think Carisforth was regarded as an excellent college, you know. But yeah. It was, you see, St. Pat's, the boys one, was owned by the diocese, I think, the Lawrence O'Toole. Carisforth was owned by the Sisters of Mercy. And Limerick, I think, was half and half, the Sisters of Mercy in Limerick and the bishop. So it was a political decision, really.
So
I had nothing to do with the selling or anything that went on after that.
I know, but it must have been... devastating for you, because you worked there, you were educated there.
It was unbelievable, yeah. I think. Yeah. We never thought that it would be, that it would happen, you know.
Yeah.
It's the kind of things, yeah. So when I came out then from that 6 years, I opted to go back to Nairobi again. And I didn't think I had the energy to get back into teaching here. After a job like that, you'd be quite tired, you know. And I hadn't taught in secondary school here. I never taught in secondary school in Ireland because I'd gone out straight after my HDIP. I did teach in primary. So I did a little bit of teaching in primary while I was waiting to go back to Nairobi, I think. And when I went back to Nairobi, they retired at 55 there. I wasn't quite 55, but most of our schools were in the city, and there was no way an expatriate or non-Kenyan would get plenty of graduates of their own at that time. And I didn't go back to... I went for a while to fill in, I think, down in a place called Kibwezi. It's halfway between Mombasa. If you ever saw that film, The Lion Eaters of Tsavo, it's near that, very near it. In fact, I think it was just around that district. And quite a humid place, and we had a they'd set up a good secondary school there, so I just filled in for a term, I think, with something. I think the most significant thing I did there was I had good experience of writing schemes of work, like, you know, on the government of Kenya were dead keen on those, like, at the time, so I was able to do that bit, and I was always interested in English. So then I came up and I was given the job of taking care of our young, with Kenyan sisters at this time. We're taking and their third stage, like a formation. First they're postulants, then they're novices, and then they're professed. And then in their case, they were getting training and things, and I had about, I had about 9 of them in college at the time. So that I was not, I couldn't hold a job with that anyway,
yeah.
an outside one. So he died there a few years ago, a priest, a Jesuit priest, Cecil McGarry. He was one of the Irish provincials at the time of Vatican II, and he was went on from that. He was a Rupe, if you remember that general. He was one of his counselors in Rome. So he was in charge at this point of a theologate that the Jesuits had set up in Nairobi mm-hmm. for all of the Jesuit scholastics, I think they called them. That they'd be about 30 now, 30 years of age. That they go through a long formation period and then they go in and do their theology, and he was in charge of that. He was the Dean of Studies there. And he asked me if I'd do some English with them. They were coming up from French speaking and whatever. So that gave me my third career, or fourth one in teaching that I went into. I taught them. I just did 6 weeks with them, intensive really, 5 hours a day. And
did they, as soon as they were ready to face the world, where did they go? Did they stay 4 years in Nairobi, or did they emigrate after that?
Oh, well, they would have come from Congo and Madagascar, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Chad,
so
all those people.
They'd
have gone back to, they belong
to
those.
For their own places,
You see, they would have come from different, the East Africans ones wouldn't have joined those classes because they would have English. These were from the French-speaking colonies, former
and
French.
How easy did they fit into the order? I mean,
they fitted in very well.
Did they?
They would have, one of the things I learned that they do before they come up to do their theology, they've done their philosophy, and they would have done their philosophy all together as well in Kinshasa, in French. Mm-hmm. The English-speaking had to go down there and learn French. And now they came up and the French-speaking had to learn English, so that all of the Jesuits in Africa would be coming from a common experience and knowing one another and so on. And they would have gone back then to their own provinces, really. They were from different provinces.
Mm. That was very rewarding work for you. And how many years did you do that?
It would only be part of the year now. Like, I take the ones who weren't, because they could do their seminars through French or English. So many of them that would want to go to, they did, to go to America places to do further stuff for their own, they needed to have, they would like to do, and the brighter ones and so on, would like to do further studies in America. So they would be keen to do their seminars in English, and they would, and the others wouldn't, it would be accepted, they would do it, which was most enlightening.
What happened afterwards when you had to leave that then? Did you come back again?
I went to a funeral in Kisumu, which is up near the lake, and the English Sisters of Mercy had started a school there, and the sister had to go home, I think her family or something like that. The father had died or the mother had died or something like that, and she needed, anyway, her time was up there. And they were looking for a principal, and they hoped to get a principal for a secondary school they had boarding from one of the African congregations, because their policy was they'd set up the school, which they did beautifully, in before they had done others besides this one. After 10 years, then they'd hand it over. But they couldn't get, none of the African congregations that were kind of around the area had people ready, because the universities used to go on strike, and a three-year course was taking 4.5 or 5, and if they hadn't departed themselves at that point, they weren't ready to take over. So they said to, they hoped our congregation would do it, but we hadn't the people either. Like, but our young African sisters who were with me at that funeral and heard this said, and they turned to me and said, we don't see why you couldn't do that.
And you took it on.
I said, 2 years. Which I was very lucky to say, because it was very hard. It was right beside, Kisumu is the third biggest city in Kenya. Nairobi is the first one, Mombasa is the second, and Kisumu is the third. If you remember, the history of Kenya was really a big watershed, and it really is the railway that ran, not to develop Kenya, but that ran from the coast, Mombasa, up to Uganda. Because that was it controlled the Nile, you see, and now Nile controlled Egypt, and Egypt controlled the Suez at the end of the 19th century, so Uganda was very important. So this one that stopped in Kenya at Kisumu, the railway, was really for the development of Uganda. and Kisumu was never really kind of, it was neglected from the time of Kenyatta because they are different people, the Luo. They were brighter. Tom Mboy, if you remember hearing of him, he was Luo from around there. But they're kind, I don't know, I thought they were naive politically, you know. They'd be bright, they were the professors in the university, the judges, the lawyers, that. But they didn't seem to have sense. They followed their leaders blindly, you know. Mm. And we had watched with interest what was going on in Nairobi because Kenyatta had his next right-hand man just after independence was a Luo for political reasons, of course. Oginga Odinga, I think, was his name. He died there some years ago. His son is one of those that are making noises now in Kenya with Mwai Kibaki. And he was very pro-Russian. And he was Home Affairs Minister. And Kenyatta only left Kenya once. He went on a tour somewhere, England or wherever, after independence, and he left him in charge. But he left in charge of him. He was Home Affairs, and he was his deputy, the second vice president. He left a detective in charge of him, who was Henderson, I think, who had been the fellow rounding up all the Mau Mau. So the first thing Odinga did was to fire the man that was supposed to be keeping an eye on him, and they suspected that he was sowing seeds of Russian or communism or whatever, I don't know. But anyway, that was it. Kenyatta went up there, but they did something at a meeting, I forget what it was, in Kisumu, and they used to say up in Kenya that the soldiers shot their way from that into Kericho. Do you remember the father that died there, Father Roach, a couple of months ago and was buried?
That's right, yes.
He was up there in Kericho, which is the tea planting place, and Kisumu was neglected after that.
So for those 2 years, it was really hard there, was it?
It was very hard.
And what did you experience yourself personally?
Personally, myself, well, it was very hard work. I suppose the biggest problem I had was the water. One of the tasks I was given was to kind of, they had built the place very well. They had a little chapel, they had the dormitories, they had all of that. But there wasn't a good admin block. But I couldn't do it until I did something about the water, because we had taps and we had supposedly flush toilets and things, but we were never getting water. It was stopped far up the line that came down, you know, whatever. They used to turn it off, so we didn't get water. And we had to have places as big as this house now, but to be, let's take these two rooms together. And we had deep tanks that we stored the water. We took it from the roofs.
Oh, yes, the rainwater.
Rainwater, yeah. And the girls would have to pull it up in buckets, and I was afraid.
Oh, was that drinking water as well?
It was everything. Yeah. So we got, I think, did we build a tank? I think we did build a tank. I had with the building for it. The first thing I had to deal with was water anyway, and to get drinking water, because most of my time and most of the time, so I was with the English sisters. I had to take these children with typhoid, any of these kind of things, very virulent malaria there. The worst thing that happened to me there, I might have had a few more worse things since, but a child died in the school. Now, nobody dies a natural death in that country, you know, in that particular place, because it could be spirits, it could be spells, it could be anything, but somebody is to blame. And they have a big cult of funerals and deaths and all of that, where people die and so on. So she died. I suppose it was from malaria. I don't know whether it was from this. I tried to have a post-mortem for her, but the family wouldn't allow it. She may have been pregnant, I don't know. But I was happy that her parents had seen her, her family had seen her the Sunday before and thought she looked awfully well. And she was sat in my class on a Thursday morning, and she was dead 24 hours afterwards.
And did that really upset you?
Oh, very much, yeah.
Why?
Well, number one, I think the staff thought I neglected her, you know, which I didn't. I mean, there was one sensible one there and said, look, it's after... It had happened up in the minor seminary where there was an African priest in charge about a month before that, and he had had got time to bring him into Nairobi or to Kisumu and that, and he still died. You know, there was it's very often like Europeans got that, maybe two places were bad for it, Mombasa and Kisumu, and any of the kind of things they didn't work, the what they would give them. So whether it was that or whether, yeah, I don't know.
But tell me now, so after that then, we started this interview talking about the history of where the South County Dublin here. Did you come back to here then after that? Or
I came straight from Kisumu here, yeah.
And what year, can you remember?
In December again, 1994.
And that was still the convent, the old,
it was the old
convent there.
And I came back to stay for 1 year and to do a course in teaching English to speakers of other languages, you know, this one that I had knew now that my secondary and whatever I was doing in English, even though I was teaching it as a, you know, as a second language really in Kenya, it did not prepare me for really teaching it as it should be taught. You know, there's a lot of listening that has to be done, and there's a lot of pair work and all that kind of stuff that had to come in. So, yeah.
But so in that case, then you were up against it. But how it must have been only 1 or 2 years before you actually moved down here. Yeah,
Just four.
Was it 4 years? Yeah. And so you went through that transition as well, you know.
I got a job. I wanted to teach as well because I had reached the magic year of 60 then, or I would be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I went for a few months over to Wales to do a long retreat and things. I would need to teach for a while here to get my pension because a small little bit of... I'd only 5 years done in Ireland or something because with professional...
Imagine, in all our years.
Mm-hmm. And... my sister had done a lot of that work to find out how long I had, you know, and would I get, and I would. You wouldn't get a pension if it was less than five. And I stayed, when I went in there, I was meant to teach sixth class. I said, I'd like to teach fourth, it's nice and comfortable in the middle. But they said, sorry, we need it for sixth, yeah, up in that school there. And I was about to teach sixth, and then Sister Katharina, who was the principal, again, was elected into something in August, and that was a convent school, so they said, would you do it? So I duly asked the other sister who was there, and I said, is there anyone else? And she said, no, she wouldn't be keen, so. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And I loved it there, really, because, like, there were infants as well, and it's always lovely to see the infants growing, like, so much as they do so quickly there and settling in. So, but when I was in, they said... Board of Management said you're to stay there for 5 years. You're to stay there till you retire. There are too many changes of principals here. So I did.
So you're principal out there for...
I was principal for the last 5 years.
Were you? Yes. And so kind of...
I was principal up in Kisumu too, you see. That's why I had all the responsibility of water and bringing people to hospital
You were back now in a very much more civilised situation.
Yes.
Hugely different circumstances.
Yes, yeah.
And did you meet with any challenges during that particular part of your life?
I do. Yeah. You always have challenges where there are human groups.
Yes, so there was parent meetings and all of that.
I didn't mind those. I think I was glad to come out because all of the Education Act had been passed in 1998.
But can I ask you first, what were the challenges? What were the difficulties that you faced?
What would I say now? I suppose there'd be personal difficulties sometimes, and I suppose the kind of challenges that were coming in with this new syllabus, a lot of policies to be done, and it's a different way of operating. The schools have changed immensely.
But did you find it a challenge with the the majority of lay teachers now coming on board, and
no, I'd always worked with lay teachers.
And there was no problem in that sense.
When I'd worked, even as far back as Moran Road, we always had a lot of lay teachers in our school, the majority really, always. Mm. Yeah. So I wouldn't have found that difficult at all. And I had some wonderful people there, really. Mm. And very great parents, and
but
it
do you
was
know
a
the
well-run
way,
school.
But do you ever get the feeling that you might have been kind of, well, you were getting near retirement age in any case, yeah, but that some of the sisters were being kind of pushed by the new, say...
No, because none of them showed an interest in taking up the job when I was leaving to somebody from outside that came in. I don't think they applied. Because, I mean, you see, you'd break ins there and all kinds of things. And I was often down there at 12:30 at night, you know, and Saturdays. And we moved down here in 1999. I was the last to come in because the primary school didn't close until they came in the beginning of June, which was vacated. I said I couldn't come down until the school was closed above because we were whatever and they were coming up for lunch in the convent. And I had set aside this Saturday, in the first Saturday in July, to get my things together and to come down here. And we had workmen in doing some job on windows, and they came up and knocked at the door on the Saturday morning and said, "I'm afraid you have to come down to see something here." They were working on Saturday because they wanted to finish the job. And I said, "What's wrong?" They said, "Windows. 3,100 worth of windows had been broken on the Friday night." Now, I spent also... The caretaker was on holiday. The man we used to get to do these things, I don't know where he was either. I went to the Yellow Pages, I think, to get somebody to mend. And I said, "Board them up." I had learned that much. Board them up, and I'll come back here on the 31st of August, and we'll put the glass in, because I had learned before, you know, we had a lot of glass, there was a lot of glass in it, and it had been a big school, because there was there was about between 500 and 600 there when I was there, and there had been, when the classes were bigger, there were more. They'd break them the first night of the holidays, and then, because you said there were no houses around it at all, I said, Colosh Inn was across the wall, Temple Owen was further over there, and because we had a lot of fields, playing fields around and things, we had no fence that you could put around or gate or anything. And I tried to get a fence up, and the council came back and they said, for aesthetic reasons, it would spoil the avenue. I agreed with them because there were beautiful trees there and everything, but it was very difficult. The guards used to say, you know, the trouble with this is you don't have a proper thing, and they can all escape across that wall over to what's now Temple Roan Place, which had been part of the farm. So I had to get these people to put up that thing anyway, and I had to bring down. I couldn't tidy my things to bring down. I had to just throw in everything, and it's the worst thing when you're moving that you don't do it clear out, you know.
But you moved so many times in your life.
I did. But I still went up for 1 year after that, teaching up there. You know, I went up from here.
Up where?
To St.
Oh, did you?
To teach there. Yeah, I was still teaching.
So you stuck it out for 5 years. And they were the 90s, the late 90s.
Yes,
now.
Yes.
How many of you, how many of the community were how many of you now here?
Yeah, four. We four now. We had five, but one died, and then somebody came in instead of her, and then she's moved over to a place she's doing. She was a nurse. She worked in the hospice, and then she's doing some pastoral care now to do other.
So were you close to the last of a Mercy sister actually having principalship of...
I was the last one up there. Oh, no, Sister Margaret. We got a laywoman in, but I think she took a year off at some stage, and Sister Margaret was still there, and Sister Aileen was in the school, and Margaret was acting principal for a few years. She just came out, I think, 1 or 2 years ago. Yeah, yeah, but she's not... She would be younger, you know, a lot, yeah.
So you're comfortably retired now, are you, after all those years here?
Yes. I find the retirement really very busy. After the retirement, I visited America for a longish holiday with my sister, and I came back and I did this course I wanted to do 5 years previously. I hadn't forgotten it. That's what one about for speakers of other languages, and I got that. And that would have been in 2001, mm-hmm. and I retired in 2000, and I started teaching with the Dublin VEC in September, and I'm still teaching with them.
Are you, yeah. Indeed?
Part-time only, of course.
Yes.
And I also...
Which
Tala, school? Tala Adult Aid.
Were you?
Yes. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Very interesting.
But I can't finish this interview without asking you about your own people down in Kerry, the Ferreters. How far back can you trace the Ferreters?
I can only trace it to my great-grandfather, and I'm not sure that I have got his name correctly. I know the grandfather. My father was the youngest of the family, and his mother died when he was 2. And when I look back on it, he hardly ever talked about family, you know. He didn't know his mother. And I think he was kind of brought up by my aunt, who would have been the eldest of that family. She'd have been about 17 years older, so I think she was like a mother to him. And I discovered when I looked at the papers in the library in Tralee or whatever it was, that I thought that there are a lot of Ferreters written down for there. Now, I've looked at the Griffith Land things, and I've looked at the baptismal certificates, and I've looked at, as far as I could, some of the, you know, the... I didn't look at... I think it was the 1911, or was the 1901, whichever was the one that was out a couple of years ago.
And when you talk about your home place, it's Castle Gregory.
It's Glenahoo, a place called Glenahoo.
And Glenahoo?
That's the Ferreters, yeah.
Yeah, and that... town's land is in what parish?
Clahan, I suppose.
Is Clahan, it Clahan?
Castle. And so that's with Castle Gregory, yeah. Now, I thought that the Ferreters were there because there are a number of Ferreters written down. And, I mean, you see the way they always had the sons, the same names as the fathers, and the families went the same and that kind of thing. But there were kind of a few strange names in among the Ferreters, like, you know. So I don't know whether I got it right or not, but... he had actually... I know the Ferreters came from Capathaic, which was a bit further over. Do you know that road from Strabble and that one? Strabble back?
It's the road that runs parallel with the main road, isn't it? The Dingle, say, the...
It's the Connor Pass road. Yeah. Well, if you pass Castle Gregory, which you don't pass through the village, you pass it above, then you come to a little place called Strabble. They have Tomoshin's restaurant, yeah. Go back a bit from that in Capatai on the right-hand side. There's a little house. It's kind of orange or some colour now. I believe that's where the Ferreters came from, like that we know. And they were around Kilcommon maybe or something there. My father was not born there. He was born back in Glenahoo because he was married... my grandfather... yeah, on my father's side, was married to an O'Connor woman who came from Glenahoo. And I cannot understand how she got the farm because she was not the eldest. And there were boys in the family and how it happened. And there was one of them married to... did you ever hear of John Mark Egan in Castle Gregory? He had a lot to do with the community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. His mother was what we used to call Mary O, and she was a first cousin of my father's. And Mary O'Donnell, my cousin, who lives in Strabble, says, Mary always said that her family had a better right to that place than my grandmother, who was Julia. I'd be called Sheila after her. But how she got in there, I don't know, because the first 5 of the family were born in Capathaig, and the other 4 were born back in Glenahoo. And he was called Sean Ferter, and his definitely, I think it was in the 1901 census, and the year I got for his birth matches with what I'd have got in the baptismal ones. And I haven't been able to look at the 1911 ones yet. Then his son Michael was in the farm after him. His wife died and left young children, 4 girls and 1 boy, James. James was killed in the hill up... do you know Machinaboe?
I do.
He was killed up on a cliff there.
That's
in the early
way over in the other side now, isn't it?
It's up from
Machinaboe.
It's you pass it if you're going the hill over from Glenahoo up to Anaskaw.
That's, yeah.
well, Machinabo is the place that's down on this side. And somewhere up above that, he was minding sheep, and he slipped or something like that, and he was about to be married, and there was no boy then. The three of the girls became nuns, and the other one was married into O'Connor's, in what you call. So another uncle came down from Bonogue and took over the farm, and that was Johnny, his brother, who would have been the one above my father, the second youngest. And his son Jackie took over, and Jackie had 12 children. There's only one of them left now, and he's not married, so the house is, you know, if you like, he's alone there. Like, it's so sad to see all these houses alone that were full of people when I knew them long ago, you know. Yeah.
And so he's a bachelor now, living
in that house. Yeah.
And when he dies, what'll happen?
Well, I don't know. Mm. I don't know.
But they're all away working.
So
you grew up down there.
I grew up in Onascol.
In Onascol.
My father married and went up to Onascol.
Oh, he moved over to Onascol.
Yeah.
To a farm or to?
No, he did tailoring.
Oh yes.
And he.
What was your dad's name?
Thomas.
Oh, Thomas.
Tom.
And he was a tailor in Onascol.
Yes. Yeah, up at the top of the village there.
And who did he marry there?
He married a woman from Clan as well. They moved up after they married.
What was her name?
Mary Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald.
Oh yes. Yeah. Yes. So, how many siblings?
One brother and two sisters, four of us, three girls in the family and one boy.
Where did you come in?
The eldest.
Oh, were you? So, talk to me about where did you go to school then?
I went to school in Onascol, which was just a little bit over the road, if you know Onascol. Do you know where the school is coming into Onascol village?
I do, on the left-hand side.
It's only a couple of houses.
Yeah.
But from here down to that.
Who was the schoolmaster there at the time?
There was a boys' school and a girls' school in my time.
Oh, yeah.
Bridie Moriarty. She had a part in Scott's Hotel or some kind of a hotel. She was quite a character. Do you know her? Never married. Yeah?
No, I don't. No. Bridie?
Moriarty. Yeah. And there was a Katie Driscoll from camp.
Oh, yes.
And a first cousin of my mother's. Was there a teacher in my time as well, Angela Fitzgerald. She married a vet in Killarney afterwards. Mm. And they were the three. Then I went to Dingle, to the convent, and got a scholarship. You know, we did the county council scholarship that time. My mother was sick for a couple of years when we were young. She spent a couple of years in the bonds in Tralee.
With TB, was it? Or?
I don't know. It couldn't have been TB unless it was her back. But whether it was off the bones or not, I don't know, because she was in a ward anyway, so she wouldn't have been in a ward if she was with that. Then I went to, I was in Dingle in the Presentation Convent, and then I did the, whatever they do to go into the prep, we call it, I think, to go into the preparatory as a
teacher. And you got the scholarship?
Yeah. I got the scholarship, yes, and I got the prep to Colossdeed. I went to Colossdeed in 1949, and I was there for 4 years, and then I went to Carisfort. Trained for 2 years and then taught 1 year.
What time in your life did you make the decision to enter the convent?
At the end of the year I was teaching, yeah. I suppose I thought about it before, but my mother, that first cousin that I said was teaching with us, had a cousin, Sister Saline, who was a Presentation convent in Dingle. And I mean, her aunt was married to my mother's uncle. Okay, you know, so they were connected.
Why the Mercy Sisters? Why not the Presentation? Or
I was trained in Carisfort. Oh, yes. That was it. And Sister Saline, the one I talked about, she told my mother, whatever you do, if she wants to go in a convent, make sure she's trained first. You know, it's a bit of a distraction. You know, really is. Yeah, and. I did that, and then I taught for a year, and I don't know, I was in Carisfort, and I suppose if Sister Saline was around, I might have considered the Presentation in Kerry, you know, I don't know.
Life would have taken a wholly different angle.
Yeah.
But listen, it was lovely to come and chat to you this afternoon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You'll
have a lot of editing to do in that.
I will. it's Sister Cora, isn't it?
Cora. Yeah.
And why did you? How did you get that name?
Well, our parish at home is in Annisquam is the parish of the Sacred Heart. And I don't think my mother was too pleased that I was entering the convent at all, you know. And, well, she said, if you are, better take something with the name of the Sacred Heart anyway. Of course, she was sick for a long time herself, and she was a very devout woman, you know. So, and when we went to the convent that time, like, we didn't go home, you know, for years. Not for years.
Yeah.
So it was a big wrench, really. Yeah.
It was. I mean, it was institutional in a big sense, wasn't it?
I think it was harder on our parents than it was on us, you know.
Yeah.
Really, wasn't it on our families, really? I say to myself, you know, I was the eldest of the family. None of them were finished. And that I just went, like, and I didn't give it a thought, really, you know.
Yeah.
There was one who was with me, as I said, we were 15, and she stayed out for 13 or 14 years or something and helped her family, you know. Mine never asked me to do that. And I mean, I think they were, you know, that what it was like in the 40s and 50s now.
Yeah. Tell me, any regrets?
No.
Would you do it all over again?
I would, I think, yes, yeah.